Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Today on Experience Focused Leaders, I am joined by none other than Sami Inkinen. Sami is co-founder and CEO of Virta Health, a unicorn that's on a mission to reverse type 2 diabetes and obesity in 1 billion humans. Sami previously co-founded Trulia, scaled it to an IPO, and sold it for $3.5 billion. Sami, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Alex. Excited to be here, and thanks for the very, very kind introduction.
Well, that is one part of it, but there's another part of it that, you know, I think is really even more remarkable, is that you have many other hats in terms of being a, you know, double unicorner and a father. You are also a performance athletic superstar and also a mindful human being. So that's kind of a really rare combo of qualities to bring together. Can you tell us a little bit about this kind of non-sexy, you know, part of Sami that sort of is the professional, you know, success story, but the part of like you accomplishing your other passions and your other identities?
Yeah, well, you reference sports, so maybe I'll start from there, although that's definitely not the most important identity. I would say being a husband and father to two girls is definitely above and beyond anything else. But you mentioned sports. Yeah, so I've done endurance sports all my life, and since moving to America 2003, got pretty serious about triathlons and did the Hawaii Ironman World Championship 7 times, I believe, back-to-back, and still race bikes and take it positively seriously, I would say. So yeah, it's a big part of my life. But I would say, why is it a big part of my life? It's one, I just love it. And I've sometimes said that to me, human experience, if I only use my able body, my legs and arms, hands, to move my brain from one meeting or Zoom meeting to another, it's a very limited human experience, like super limited human experience. So I love this feel. I just love sports and training and competing. I love this feeling of breathing hard and sweating and this full body experience, which quite frankly, we humans evolved to be and do. So that's one part of it. The second one is obviously just doing sports. You're healthy and you feel much better, I find. And, you know, people sometimes talk about mind and body, but at the end of the day, it's just biology. So it all goes to. So when you do a lot of sports, you just feel much better. And there's more and more evidence, although I don't need the evidence, that you think better and are better professional as well. And then lastly, I will say that from a sort of thinking perspective, I've been a founder operator more or less nonstop since March 2000. So that's about 20 years, 25 years of building 3 companies as a founder, operator, leader, CEO. It's fun, but it's super hard. And I find that having a very distinct, like a story, identity in your head, or multiple of them, like a parent, husband, whatever, the founder, CEO, and then in my case, athlete, the third one, is very helpful, because if one thing's not working very well, you have some probability that something else is going a little bit better. So I find that it gives a lot of sustainability mentally, that you have those different interests, and then you know, you struggle in one and maybe you're doing better in another. So there's a little bit of context.
To build on that, so one of the stories that you've shared in the past is about having achieved all this kind of wonderful success with Trulia, right? And then having kind of all your dreams, financial goals, whatever come true, and then still kind of finding that little things bother you. And so there's little things in your mind that kind of bother you. And you started paying attention to that, and you know, went and retreat and you know, started a journey on meditation. This is something that people wouldn't expect necessarily from, you know, given the background of an athlete and already like so intensely kind of finding other outlets of sort of reducing stress, right? Like that you would also pursue mindfulness. Tell us a little bit about, you know, that element of your journey and, you know, how do you bring that to your family life, to your work life, to your athletic life?
Yeah. So I'm a kind of an accidental meditator now, I guess about 12 years, which may be a somewhat common experience that people don't seek for something new, such as meditation, unless something's broken, so to speak. Because if you're fine, you're busy, you don't even think about it. But yeah, so just taking back more than 10 years now, around the time that Trulia went public. First of all, I will have to say for context that money in sort of professional adventures has never been the goal, or maybe not even a goal. Yeah. I feel lucky to genuinely say this, that I've always felt I've never had a job for a single day. Well, actually, I worked at Microsoft and McKinsey. That did feel like a job, but and I respect those organizations. But I've always felt that I've just done cool stuff. I've done cool stuff. I built cool stuff. And the journey really has been the main destination, including over the almost a decade that we were building Trulia. So I've never been kind of chasing a specific milestone. That said, I had left my operational role at Trulia at the very, I'm still on the board, at the time that a company went public. And so I didn't have a full-time job. So I had a lot of time on my hand. I was living in New York. Company goes public. And yes, this, you know, there was a specifically like a financial, positive financial outcome as well. And I wasn't busy doing anything. I didn't have the next cheese in front of my nose that, or door to open or whatever, the task to do. And as you kind of referenced, I vividly remember this one day, you know, whatever it was, Thursday, week after the IPO, and, you know, walking to the gym, Chelsea Piers, where I used to work out, and some minor thing, which was like 1/1,000,000th of the kind of obstacle that you might have as a, you know, CEO or operator, you're building a growth company, was broken. And I think it's something to do with my washing machine or whatever. And, you know, I'm walking to the gym and I'm just thinking of this, like, whatever it was, like, we don't have, you know, detergent or soap or the washing machine broken. I just got so pissed and anxious and angry about that silly thing. And in my head, it was just going circles, like, wait a second. Here I am, I'm happily married. Financially, I don't have to work if I don't want to. I'm living in New York, the coolest place in the world, or one of the coolest. Yeah. And I'm just so anxious about freaking washing machine not being perfect. And hopefully I have another, whatever, 50, 60 years of life left. And if my mind is going to these kinds of places, this is going to be a miserable 60 years. So long story short, I was like, wait a second. I've trained, you know, every muscle in my body as an athlete. But there's one thing that I haven't trained. I've educated my brain, but I don't think I understand how my brain works, because this is insane. I'm supposed to be like, I have everything I need. Why am I worried about this? So long story short, that kind of, that was my broken thing I wanted to fix. And I was like, wait a second. I really don't understand how my mind works. I thought I was in control of it. But throughout my life, you know, I was always busy doing the next thing. So there was never like an empty moment where thoughts run alone and create stories. And so that led me to a 10-day silent. It was a Vipassana style meditation, Taiwan, Taipei, 10-day silent meditation. So I went from 0 to 60 miles an hour in one go. And obviously, because I didn't speak Mandarin at the time, it was easier to do silent meditation retreat in Taiwan than in New York. So lucky I went there. But anyways, that's kind of, that started my meditation retreat, and we're happy to talk about meditation, but I've kind of meditated, not hours, more like minutes a day ever since. So that was 12 years ago.
And so I could very much relate on a much tinier scale. I think when, you know, Remember Success Factors exited, I was kind of, was sort of living in a great kind of position in my life. Just got married. We had a beautiful wedding, French wife. You know, I was like, we had a baby. The baby was healthy. Exit. We lived in London, which to me was the kind of the equivalent of New York for you at the time. And then we were like just, you know, fighting with each other over little things around childcare in that case. Like we were like really agitated about, you know, not, you're breaking our precious little child, and you know, like, and then all the cultural styles came in. And so that kind of led me to a journey to eventually, like more recently, led to proper meditation, but journey to more awareness of some of these goals that we set for ourselves, that we think I will be enough if I have an exit, I will be enough if I get married, I'll be enough if I get a promotion, you know, like, and I'm sure you people then eventually find that that's actually quite the opposite. And then you kind of learn that, yes, you got to enjoy a destination and like adjust and course correct. And I think to kind of get back to the sort of readjustment, you know, how do you motivate your team with all this knowledge, right? Because like I would find, you know, I know you from Stanford, and so obviously I found you in some ways like very accessible and direct and friendly, but your sports routine was very intimidating to the mere mortals like myself. And so, you know, I wonder, how do you kind of bring yourself to your colleagues, share your journey, share your vulnerabilities in a way to make you accessible, and also share how they could, you know, not get freaked out if they're not happy once they get the promotion, you know, yeah, and, you know, and it doesn't meet all their life dreams.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a couple of things. First of all, as a leader, I think authenticity is key. You mm-hmm. know, you can listen to a podcast or read a blog post or whatever post, and there's all this like, oh, you need to be a peacetime CEO, wartime CEO, founder mode, or this or that, or behave like this famous leader or founder or CEO, which is complete BS, in my opinion, because you have
Let's just hear the guy that's the ultimate beast mode CEO is saying this is all BS. I love it.
Yeah, it is all BS that you sort of imitate for a couple of reasons. Number one is, which is kind of my point, that you just have to be authentic. Authenticity key as a leader. And then secondly is, if you are to guide a company or grow a company over extended periods of time, I'm talking more than, say, 3 years, you need many modes. It's kind of like driving a car and saying that you have to hold the steering wheel tight and push the gas pedal. It's like, yeah, it's
and only turn right.
Acceleration, or not even do that. It's fine as long as the road is straight. But once you have first car, you go off.
Yeah.
It's the same thing in building a company. Like, yeah, sometimes you're peaceful, sometimes warm mode and whatnot. So that's kind of the point one, that I think you have to be authentic and bring authenticity as a leader. In terms of motivating people, people have very different drivers. It could be fear. It could be they lived in poverty and they just really want to make enough money that they can provide for their family and buy a house, for example. For other people, it's, you know, pathological promotion and proving to their people around. Whatever it is, people have different drivers. I don't think I, as a CEO, can be the psychologist and therapist. And so I try to hire people who are as self-motivated as possible. That's kind of the second point I would say. And then whatever drives them, I hope they have it inside, and hopefully it comes from a good place. If it doesn't come from a good place, I'm not the therapist to fix them. But I try to hire people who are self-motivated. So that's kind of the second point. Then what I do say and do to help with motivation is this. Just, I'll mention two examples. Just one is, you have to, if you don't have a focus in kind of something in front of the company, the entire company, that must happen, whether that's an existential threat in terms of running out of cash or competition or whatever. And by the way, those come all the time, but sometimes they don't. If you don't have something like that, you have to engineer one. Like, you can't just be, let's come back on Monday, turn the cranks, back on Monday, turn the cranks. It's just, it's not even fun for me. It's not fun for anyone. So you want to engineer short to mid-term milestone objective, make it exciting, make it meaningful. Not lie, but you pick something that's like, Very exciting in front of us.
Raises the stakes. You want to
Yeah,
raise the
raise the
stakes,
stakes.
basically.
And you want to, it's kind of like people who do sports, like, I don't know, you run a marathon. Most people will tell you that, oh my God, what a bliss 2 weeks after the marathon. I did a great run, first marathon, whatnot. But then after 2 or 3 weeks, they're like, I need to sign up for the next one. Because, like, just going jogging every day just doesn't feel as special. So I think it's the same thing in the professionals. That's one thing I do engineer, and sometimes the world engineers it for us. So
So right now, everybody is using AI as the sort of whipping kind of engine, right? Like, we're going to be annihilated, or like when Elon Musk introduces his policies, that kind of says, kind of, can we channel our inner Elon?
Could be. Another example that I is just communicate. So what I do try to remind people about this: find joy from the doing and the process and the building, as opposed to the specific milestones. Is, and I have different stories and anecdotes that I use. But one of my favorites is, you know, people want to get promoted and bigger this and bigger that. I say, well, you know, in a professional setting, it is like a pie eating contest where the winner gets more pie to eat. So you better like eating pie today. Because it's true, right? You're like, you enter an employee, you become a manager, you become a director, you become a VP, whatever. Like, you know what it is? It is a pie eating contest where the winner gets more pie to eat. It's not like you reach a level where it's like eternal happiness and no problems. No, if you climb the organization with more team, more budget, whatever, guess what you have? More headaches, right? You know this.
Yeah.
It's like,
well, it's kind of like it goes two ways. Shit flows downstream and shit flows upstream. It's one of those, like, funny.
So anyways, but those are some of the thoughts in terms of how to motivate. But generally, authenticity, and then hiring people who are motivated. And by the way, I guess I mentioned lastly, now that I run Virta again on a mission to reverse diabetes and obesity in 1 billion people, it's obviously a very mission-driven company.
Yeah.
We only get paid if we reverse diabetes and or obesity. So there is that sort of mission-driven motivation and attracting, the old saying, more missionaries than mercenaries. Hopefully there's like a self-selection that people who come in like, hey, I really want to see this happen, as opposed to, oh, we are crypto day trading and the only goal is to, you know, end the week with more cash than you had last week.
So actually, on that note, I'll quote you. You said Virta will not fail. Not when you're in a mission to do something so remarkable. So obviously now, this was said a while ago, now it, like, you will not fail, your success, but still, startup journey is always precarious. What gives you this confidence and conviction? Maybe is it something goes back to your childhood? Is it just something that you've cultivated over time? Is it the athletic training?
Yeah.
Like, tell me, like, about where's this inner strength comes from that you clearly have.
First, I have to say I wonder where I said that. That those are strong, bold words, even if they came from my mouth. I will say, and I say that because I always try to be optimistic, but grounded in reality and not bullshit to my team. And for example, it's like you can never promise the future exactly, and highlight kind of the realities, but then be optimistic that we've solved all the obstacles in the past and we can solve the next one and whatever the good things that are going on. And before I truly answer your question about the optimism and self-confidence, I will say that as a company now, you know, we have 900 employees and hundreds of millions in revenue, and we'll become profitable this year and growing, you know, about 80% year over year, at least in Q1 of this year, 2025. So we've objectively certainly climbed the first hill, because every startup has, initially you're kind of drip feeding from one investment round to another, and you really don't know if you find a product market fit and if there's there truly. So I can say that we've objectively now climbed the first hill where Virta is here to stay and reversing diabetes and obesity is real. And the next question is, are we going to climb to the top of Mount Blanc or top of Mount Everest? And hopefully from an impact perspective, it's the latter one. So I guess that keeps confidence. But I'd say generally, I think my mindsets have always been wired in a way that I on average, I think what could go right as opposed to what could go wrong. Meaning, I see the future as what if this goes right? What does it look like? And then I'm going to try to, within my inner team's limits and capabilities limits, force the right outcome. And maybe it's similar to glass half empty or half full kind of optimistic thinking, but I think that's very important for founders to think about what if this goes right, what could this mean? Because that's the only way to build something that changes things at scale. And of course, and I think some VCs use this framework as well, rather than because VCs are looking for the 1 out of 1,000 absolute crazy success story. And you can only find that if you think, what if this goes right? How big could it be? Versus like, hey, let's list the 20 reasons why this could go wrong.
Is good, right?
Because everything can fail for 20 different reasons.
Well, let's imagine things are going wrong. Finns have this word that I love called sisu that you taught me, I think. And that's kind of the, for those of you that are not Finnish, it's the kind of resilience that shows up when, not when you're strong, but when you're kind of exhausted, but you keep going. What's been your deepest sisu moment, either in building Virta or in your travels across Pacific? Tell us your sisu, proudest sisu moment.
Yeah, indeed, sisu is a word that happens to have its own Wikipedia page, and it does mean grit, determination, perseverance. Well, it really you can't translate it directly, but that's kind of what it means in Finnish language. Honestly, there's been like countless. I'll pick one or two, but this is the truth that when you look at a growth company, like even Virta, like obviously we haven't changed the world, but yeah, it's I can say that it's being an early success. You look from outside, it's like, well, it's a cool idea, reverse diabetes, obesity. If it works, I'm pretty sure they're gonna somehow make it happen. And it's like a straight line from A to B to impact, scale, whatever, success. But the reality is, it's not like that. Inside the house, it feels like a card house every day, and you have these crazy obstacles that hit you all the time. Probably one of the harder points for me was early year 2020, surprise, surprise. Even before COVID hit, like we were in this interesting point where we had just started commercialization, but it turned out to be harder in the US healthcare than I thought, which is to say that it's very slow and very expensive. You have, quote unquote, the best product in the world. And reversing diabetes is saving money. Like, what is there not to like? But our commercialization was slower than I thought. It was harder than I thought. And then COVID hits, and we don't have a lot of cash in the bank. And that was a very tough moment. I laid off 35% of the company. I think we were some 60 people at the time. So somewhere 60 plus minus, which was emotionally tough, practically tough to depart ways with, 60 amazing team members, not knowing if we have money to survive or how far we have money to survive. And then also the whole company goes virtual immediately. You're just looking at pixels on the screen all day long. So yeah, that was the kind of where I knew that if I don't show up as, again, grounded in reality, but optimistic about the future as a leader, no matter how tough it is for me, the team is potentially going to fall apart. So I need to bring my best self to the game every day. So yeah, I think that was one of those. And then obviously we made certain decisions right after, but then you're like, well, how long does it take to climb out of this? This could be 5 years, 10 years of like horrible trying to barely survive kind of situation. So yeah, that's and obviously there's techniques and tactics. What do you do then? It's like for me, it's like one, remind yourself why you're doing. I'm choosing to do this. It's a mission. Two is, well, don't worry about the things you can't affect. Like, how long is COVID going to last? Are the clients going to come back? Are they going to be buying? Is there money available? Like, I don't know. So then instead, you focus on what you can do. Every day, there's two or three things you can do. And then you just keep kind of taking steps. And I will give an example of that where I actually failed, but my wife brought me back. You mentioned this specific role. rowing from California to Hawaii in a rowboat, and it's 2,400 nautical miles, kind of straight shot. So we're like, oh,
Yeah.
maybe we can do this in 40, 50, 60 days. But the first 2 or 3 weeks, we were just going south, and the actual distance closer to Hawaii because of the storms that we were making was like 1 mile a day or something, or 1 or 2 miles, because mostly we were going south. And I was just doing the math. 2,400 divided by two, that's 1,200 days to row. And I was just totally lost. I was like, this is going to take, 3, 4 years. And then my wife said, well, if it takes 3, 4 years, we'll do 2 miles at a time. Just keep grinding. And that was just a reminder of, like, don't worry about what you can't affect.
Yeah.
Just the thing that you do, okay, 2 miles a day. 2 miles a day. And I was so close to giving up, so close. And she pulled me back, and then the storms ended, and we started making, 50 miles a day progress. And anyways, so
So impressive, man. I'm like hearing you say this. I just came back from like a family trip where I drove the family from, northern Italy to Rome. And I think that drive alone probably was like more mentally taxing. Learning to drive like Italian in itself was kind of fun, the process. But it was kind of just an adventure that was stressful. And I just can't even imagine the level of coordination that you guys figure out with your wife on kind of how to kind of motivate each other and maintains each other's energy. So what kind of examples, lessons can you share with others that are kind of in couples and are kind of tackling either tough challenges as a family, as a couple, or kind of as a couple, a family, and have other professional endeavors that they're pursuing? Because it sounds like you guys are like created some crazy playbook here.
Well, I hop into a rowing boat
Yeah.
unsupported, and row across an ocean and see if you're still together. If you're still together, you filtered
Yeah.
out the fluff. I guess that would be my advice. I will say just the one thing. We did prepare sort of relationship-wise and mentally a little bit. For the role, I'll mention one thing, and which may or may not be, well, I guess it's helpful universally. We agreed on one thing, a couple of things, but I'll mention one. Any decision that one of us makes during the role, because we are tired and stressed and exercising a lot, 16, 18 hours a day, any decision that one of us makes, which could be wrong 5 hours later or a day later, is always water under the bridge. So one of us or the other one was not allowed to kind of go back to it. And there were a lot of decisions we had to make, like the angle and the direction and storms, and do you deploy a para anchor or whatever. And you could make a wrong decision that could threaten your life even. But we agreed early on that zero
You're not gonna
back.
blame your
Yeah,
partner
no
for making.
blame. It's water
Okay.
under the bridge, because whoever is responsible for the or a decision,
Yeah.
we have to trust that they make it with the best information at hand at the time. And then after that, the chips fall where they fall. And if we can't reverse the decision, it is what it is. And it was actually very helpful.
This is really interesting. I want to shift gears a little bit to the sort of people's ability to make decisions that are good for their health, right? Because I think you're effectively in a way in science business, obviously, was what you're doing, but also you're an evangelist for this billion people that are kind of struggling, and they may be aware in some ways that they're not doing the right things for them, and yet they keep doing it. And part of the logic that happens is that people blame themselves. Oh, I didn't exercise. I didn't swim across Pacific like Sami or Road. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. I kind of ruined my diet. I lost, gained so much. And then they get in this negative spiral. Or they could blame their circumstances. They could blame their spouses and et cetera, et cetera. And I think you're providing a path out of that. I'm curious. How are you motivating this change in individuals? And then you obviously have people in the channels of distribution, right? That, as you mentioned, the complexity around American healthcare system.
that you have to persuade brokers and HR professionals and plans to embrace your approach to metabolic health. So tell us a little bit about kind of the psychology awareness that you're bringing to your end consumers and to the market as a whole.
Yeah, it's actually reasonably complicated because
Different
different
audiences.
people
Let's start
have
with the consumers.
constituents. People struggling with metabolic health, which is 70% of Western folks in Western countries, and metabolic health basically means, broadly speaking, people know two things. It's like obesity and type 2 diabetes are like two symptoms of poor metabolic health. And then cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, and so forth. But they're usually known as quote unquote lifestyle disease. And so people struggling with metabolic health, which again is 60 or 70% of adults in most Western countries, there is for many, many, I would say most people, at least when we listen to our patients coming into Virta, there is this psychological story that people tell, well, it's me, and if I have these issues, I'm failing myself. And most people who are metabolically unhealthy, they've tried sort of 5 to 10 programs in their life, like diet, exercise, and they failed all of them, obviously. And then they have this story, both conscious and subconscious, like, I'm a loser, I'm failing. And then in order to not hurt yourself again, they are afraid to try
Try.
yet another thing. That's very, very common. And so one of the things we tell to potential Virta patients coming in, we say, it's not you who failed. It was the program and the approach and the support that failed you. And it is scientifically true. If you have the wrong approach, no amount of quote unquote willpower and tools and techniques will work. So that's what we say. It's you haven't failed. The system, the program, whatever you were given failed. And in what we do, not only we provide support, but from a nutrition science perspective, we will help you eliminate hunger and craving. So this is not a willpower competition. And we can make it sustainable to you. And just as a practical example, most nutrition and quote unquote diet programs, they rely on like, eat a little bit less than you'd like to. We actually counsel our patients to eat to satiety. To eat to satiety. So even this concept for people is like, wait a second, really? Like, I leave the table when I'm like full. It's like, yes. And if you don't, we encourage you to eat certain things a little bit more. So that's on the consumer side. Now, if you're convincing a business decision maker, sometimes it just comes down to dollars and cents and say, okay, what are your concerns? Well, it's like, well, you guys are lying. It doesn't work. Well, we say, hey, well, we contractually guarantee we deliver outcomes. If you don't, you get the money back. And then there's obviously many other business decision makers. They don't want to be embarrassed and they don't want safety to be an issue. And there's all kinds of like a list of things which we have to address in different ways. But I'll just finish and say, in terms of convincing people, to me, the perfect example is a doctor, medical doctor. So I'll give you the secret. We published more than 10 peer-reviewed papers, so hundreds of, if not thousands of pages of peer-reviewed outcomes from Virta. And you would think medical doctor, if you want to convince them that send your patients to Virta to reverse diabetes, obesity, it's a peer-reviewed paper, right? That is not the best one. What's the best one? One single patient that the primary care doctor is treating comes back, who's already on Virta, has reversed their diabetes. One, although it doesn't make science, N equals one, it's an anecdote, but real world experience with the one real human being that you're taking care who reverses their
It's
diabetes.
your patient, your own patient. So it's not
Our
like
patient,
some,
but who was in the
but
panel of this primary
who
care doctor. That
got it.
convinced the primary care doctor, like, oh my God, Jill or Joe, you had type 2 diabetes. You've lost 60 pounds or whatever, 25 kilos. You're off of insulin. Incredible. What's happening to you? What are you on? Virta? They're like, oh my God, I need to send my rest of my patients there.
Got it. So what you're saying is it's fundamentally even the most. The people that you think are the most scientific, evidence-driven, which is the kind of the medical profession, they probably still need to know that that evidence exists, right? Like it still is, they like you can't escape it. But what really translates is that human story, and not just any human story, but it's a human story they could somehow connect to. It's either their
100%,
patient or
100%,
kind of a very real,
100%.
very, wow, what a great.
And it also can go sideways because if, let's say, your child I don't know, let's not talk about vaccinations, but let's say you give your child something that has 1 out of trillion probability that something bad happens. If that happens to your child, it's very likely in your mind, you're like, oh my God, nobody should eat raspberries ever, right? Picking raspberries as a random example. But that, like, if you have that visceral experience, you're like, well, those things are really bad, even if it's like statistically 100 trillion.
Sami, any last kind of bits of wisdom as we wrap up this conversation for anybody who's embracing to do something deeply meaningful and challenging in their lives? Anything that you wish you knew when you were setting out on your initial kind of founder journey 20 plus years ago?
I think you want to unexplainably fall in love with the thing that you want to do. And if you're wondering, well, I want to do an analysis on a spreadsheet. Sure, do an analysis on a spreadsheet too. But unless you feel that you've unexplainably fallen in love with the idea or the mission that you're trying to do, I don't think sort of the entrepreneurial journey is worth it. And if you're wondering, what does that feel? Just think about one of your dates that you've had with another human being, after which you're like, I don't care if I need to drive 300 miles or 3,000 miles and pull two all-nighters to go and see this person again. That's the feeling you want to be looking for. It's like unexplainable. And for each human being, it's different because that is your competitive advantage. That's the sisu that keeps you going.
You heard it here. Your edge is love. Sami Inkinen, everybody.
Got it.
The Iron Man promotes love on the Experience Focus Leaders. Thank you, Sami. You are a great human, great friend, and I think a great and inspiring leader, even for people who are not working with you directly. So I salute for what you're working on, and I think our audience will love learning more about, you know, how you're helping achieve your mission for 1 billion humans. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Alex. Thank you.
Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relayto.com, relayto.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relayto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.